This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Fairy tales have been around in various forms for hundreds and in some ways thousands of years, and many scholars argue that they have stood the test of time because they speak to many of our most deep-seated beliefs and struggles. Some psychoanalysts also believe that fairy tales can be helpful in understanding the human mind. Following in the footsteps of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, they say that by closely examining fairy tales, we can better understand both our personal challenges and the larger cultural and political struggles we face. We're joined now by a clinical psychiatrist who has examined the role of fairy tales and what they play in psychology. He uses them in his own practice. Steve Buser is a practicing psychiatrist in Asheville, co-founder of the Asheville Jung Center and chief publisher of Chiron Publications, a Jungian-oriented publication company, and he joins us now from Asheville in WCQS. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Frank. Thank you very much for having me today.
It's good to have you. I know you were listening to that last segment and, sort of talking about the fairy tales as a kind of a template, something that gets us at this notion of an archetype, something essential to human character. Is that something you think is going on in fairy tales?
Yes, absolutely. Fairy tales survived the hundreds or even thousands of years over the centuries because they tapped into something collective, some sort of wisdom that transcends the individual. That's why they're told and retold to the children over the years, and eventually why they get recorded by the Brother Grimms or other people.
How did they enter into the practice of psychiatry?
It depends on the background of the psychiatrist or psychotherapist. Myself, I come from a more Carl Jung-oriented approach, a Jungian psychotherapy. So for us Jungian-oriented psychiatrists or psychotherapists, the study of fairy tales is a significant piece of how we deal with unconscious materials, be it dreams, images, patterns that come across an individual. Not that we only use fairy tales. We use all kinds of techniques. But fairy tales are a good deposit site of where collective human wisdom lies. So we will tap into those on occasions.
Well, those patterns are crucial. Certainly they're what we enjoy and what give us comfort as children listening to them. We kind of know how the thing is going to go, right? I mean, it has its own form and we can kind of rely on it. Does this relate to something that Carl Jung's concept, though, the types that we see, the forms, the repeating forms over and over? Mm-hmm. Is this something that Carl Jung would point to the collective unconscious as an example of that?
Yes, absolutely. These patterns are called archetypes, and Carl Jung was one of the first people to look at it from an archetypal perspective. And the archetypes are rich within the fairy tales, and really any material from movies, books, drama, but fairy tales in particular because they're so rooted in there. You look at the wolf. The wolf will be a very classic archetype. The wolf can be symbolic of the aggressive, masculine, devouring energy. And young Red, who's 14 years old and trying to get to her grandmother, he has to deal with the aggressive masculine as it comes upon her.
Is this something, how are they different from fables? If we think of Aesop's fable where, the moral is actually sort of written at the end of the page. Are fairy tales meant to be more open-ended?
Yes, very much so. A fable I see as having a very clear agenda, trying to teach a moral perspective. If you look at fairy tales or myths, they're usually deeper in the collective unconscious. Mythology is more culturally related. One might think of Greek mythology or Roman mythology, where it's that culture and their tales that are coming through. Fairy tales are more acultural. There certainly are some cultural aspects to it, but they really are rooted in more the depth of the collective unconscious because they develop organically over the centuries.
How does a fairy tale speak to an individual's growth or transformation? Do you have any examples of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. As a psychiatrist, I do a number of things. I both do individual psychotherapy as well as medications and traditional medical aspects. But if I have a patient in therapy that is going through a particular crisis, very often there may be a fairy tale-like theme with that. One example would be midlife. I think midlife is a classic time where the archetypal breaks through. When I look at Into the Woods, I see Act 1 transition to Act 2. Act 2 is midlife. That's the midlife that somebody is going through. An example could be, say, an executive, a very successful executive who works for a financial institution, is a vice president of an organization, had to climb the beanstalk, in essence. This individual might have been working hard, late hours, climb the ladder, so to speak, you know, slay the giant, and the giant of job promotions, of mergers, of acquisitions, gets the gold, comes back with lots of gold. His finances are very well off, but his wife leaves him, his children don't know him, and he's left with a sense of emptiness. You know, he has climbed the beanstalk but has and killed the giant, but now is left empty. And until he deals with the giant's wife in this case, you know, or somehow engages a life that taps deeper into his meaning, he is going to be caught and off track in that place.
And of course, into the woods, the forest is the central metaphor. You talked about midlife, and I referenced Dante in his Divine Comedy begins, you know, I awakened in a dark wood. I mean, that's precisely where his journey begins.
Exactly right. The woods is such a beautiful symbol of that, similar to the ocean. The ocean or the woods are both mysterious, you know, dark, unknown, and many, if not most, Jungian folks would see the woods as a symbol of the unconscious, the collective unconscious, the archetypes, the wolves and the giants and the, you know, bakers are roaming through there. You don't know what you're really going to come across. And when you go to the woods, you surrender into the unknown because the unknown is coming to find you and is no longer in a controlled, you know, situation.
I'm interested in the life of the fairy tale itself. We've made a couple of references to the sanitized versions. If you go back and read the Brothers Grimm, it's scary, awful stuff. Even the ones that we thought we knew, the ones that make the anthologies, the ones that don't are hideous and grotesque. We really can't take it. I mean, those, it seems to me, and what you're saying is these stories are meant to bring us to those parts of ourselves that we are most afraid of, that we have shunted aside and put in the attic. And we can't even tell the story of in a way that would bring us to that. We have to kind of clean it up and Disney-fy it before we can ever even put it between the pages.
Exactly. That's the tragedy of fairy tales. When you talk about fairy tales, the initial reaction is often, oh, how cute, isn't that sweet? You know, the doctor wants to talk about fairy tales. But that's exactly what you just said, the Disney-vied, Disney version. Disney and the others that make it, you know, more for a very young age are so sanitizing the fairy tale that it's losing its meaning. It doesn't have the depth, doesn't have the grit, doesn't have the blood, doesn't have the transformative elements that are really pushing us to growth. Fairy tales ultimately are really about transformation. What are we transforming our lives into? How are those archetypes upon us in a way that leads us towards growth and a transformation? And you look at the characters through Into the Woods, and there's all kinds of transformations that are occurring. And that's really what the fairy tales are telling us.
Transformations and reformations, ideas of families coming together, communities reconstituted in ways that were never envisioned by, you know, sort of the original teller of the tale. When we look at with this idea of something being lost, the soul, the blood, the life going out of the thing, let's take a step back and again, in the life of the fairy tale, in the moment that the Brothers Grimm decide to collect these stories, we're looking at the late 19th century, a time when a lot of artists are trying to go back and capture something in their past, the Romantic era, again, a kind of where's our soul, at the height of industrial capitalism, something feels like it's being lost. I mean, is there a significance to this? This is the moment when Europe says, my God, we're losing something and it's vital to us. How do we recapture this?
Absolutely. The myths and fairy tales need to be taken in a cultural perspective, both when they're being told and retold or collected, in this case with Brother Grimm, but also for the individual and society. And even now, I mean, even now, what's in the headlines, ISIS and Iraq and Syria, we go in and slay the giant. You know, we slay Saddam Hussein or the old regime, and for a moment we think we're going to live happily ever after, but there's Act Two. Act One isn't the whole story, and there's a deeper shadow, a deeper archetype that then comes back and needs to be dealt with. So these stories are told over and over again because we forget them over and over again. We assume an easy solution, you know, globally, politically, or personally. Yet that's not the end of the story. There is no happily ever after. There's an act two where the deeper shadow, dark, you know, archetypal elements really need to be dealt with.
And you suggest we socially pay a deep price as we are now for the unintended consequences of our rash activity in the early part of this century, and going to war, slaying the giant, and now we're paying and paying over and over again, with no real result to our safety. You can ask the CIA or the NSA, and they've both said that we're now less safe than we were before those wars. That's the collective That's the collective debt that we pay. You've seen it, I guess, as an analyst with the personal price that individuals pay when they have to face this kind of battle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So these archetypal patterns develop both, you know, globally, yeah, in political and geopolitical realms, and then individually as well. And it's really the same story. It's the same space. It's just a question of, do we zoom in on the individual and the person's experience with these archetypes, with their story, with their pain, with their suffering? There's interpersonal pain, which may bring somebody to me as a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist to help deal with that pain. They may want a simple Prozac solution, which I try to steer less, you know, towards, or they may want a deeper transformative psychotherapy experience. You know, or globally, you know, we're looking to relieve our global, you know, pain and our political pain, and we might take a too-quick solution that works in the short term but doesn't identify the larger, you know, perspective or picture.
What do we make of the fact, too, that I've always been curious about why a particular story gets locked in time? As you say, these stories evolved mm-hmm. in some ways out of the myths for thousands of years. The fairy tales themselves, at least Grimm's, the ones that we are familiar with, are pretty well set in a kind of medieval period. There are castles, there are swords, there are mm-hmm. knights, you know, in some of these stories. Why did they stop there for us? What is it about that period that got them sort of mm-hmm. locked in?
Well, they did and didn't stop there. Certainly, if you look at the Brothers Grimm, then yes, they really focused in that period and where they're at. But the pattern is persistent, and it's told time and time again. I love the quote, "Be careful what you say, that the children are listening. They will hear the story." If you look at sort of a modern day, you know, version, probably the best, you know, known, you know, in our current culture would be Star Wars or something along those lines. In fact, it was even mentioned, you know, earlier of how George Lucas, you know, engaged some of the people that know more about the archetypal patterns. Luke Skywalker is really just a fairy tale, you know, story. Luke Skywalker is the hero. There's a dark, you know, father figure, you know, that's persecuting. There's a wise, you know, interior figure, Obi-Wan Kenobi. And there's a swashbuckling event that occurs to save the princess. In fact, they even use so many of the same motifs. The swords become lightsabers, and the princess is still a princess, and the ships become starships instead of sailing ships. So the patterns are really repetitive, and if you go to the movies on a Saturday and think of it through a symbolic, you know, lens, you see these patterns from fairy tales, you know, over and over again in the modern day, you know, stories as well.
I wonder if they are as effective now, and maybe I'll ask you as a psychoanalyst in trying to help people come to grips with this, to make a connection with themselves as a whole, if it's become far more difficult now in this hyper-atomized individual competitive society that is so inhuman. Have the stories lost their power, and how do you get a person to reconnect in a society that mm-hmm. glorifies this kind of violent individualism and scapegoating?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say they've lost their power, but I think the power becomes more hidden in modern-day society. You know, way back, you know, people weren't bombarded by information, by distractions, by entertainment, by the so many things that we are, you know, today. So sitting by the campfire or the common, you know, room, they would much more easily be able to tell the stories or reflect on them. We are so bombarded by them, we have to specifically slow down and look. One reason why we have this seminar series, we're teaching an entire five-week seminar series from Zurich on fairy tales, because people aren't aware of that as much. And we go deep. We're spending 8 hours really dissecting the psychological meaning behind the fairy tales. We published a dozen books, you know, on fairy tales to really open up the awareness, you know, of that. I think the key is to, for us as individuals and a culture, is to slow down, to unplug a little bit, to be reflective. As you're reading a book, as you're watching a movie, as you're reading a blog, a tweet even, where, you know, is the deeper meaning, you know, behind that? Sometimes they need, yeah, you know, therapist. I'm not a psychoanalyst directly, but I'm a Jungian psychiatrist and therapist. So I've got a lot of training within that. We'll slow down the piece if we can, meet for hour sessions, regular basis, and really try to analyze, you know, what is happening within the archetypal level with people. But you have to slow down. You've got to unplug.
How dynamic are these symbols and archetypes? I mean, in a sense, they're patterns. They keep recurring. Mm-hmm. They have a message for us. If I explore their meaning in my own life, are they kind of a lockstep meaning? The wolf is the unrestrained masculine side that I'm afraid of? Or can it be more dynamic than that?
Very, very much dynamic. In fact, it loses its energy if it isn't dynamic. There's a difference between a symbol and a sign. A sign is what you just mentioned a moment ago. A sign is a translated meaning that everybody knows, a stop sign. Everybody knows a stop sign means stop. There's no question. There's no ambiguity. A symbol has deep archetypal meaning that can vary completely from person to person, setting to setting. A cross. You know, a cross might be a holy, faith-filled piece for me, or it might be an image of crusades and evil. The symbol has very powerful meaning. One critique of Christianity this day is that some of our symbols are being watered down into signs. So what was a powerful moving symbol is now a sign that people quickly slough off. No, I know what that means. This means that. That means that. A symbol has a deeper meaning and is alive and dynamic and grabs you. When you're possessed by a symbol and an archetype, it's not a pleasant thing necessarily. It's an agonizing thing. It grabs your soul. It pulls you down. It urges you to seek therapy or treatment because it is so it blows you away. And if not, then something isn't engaged correctly in it.
Steve, thank you so much. Been great talking with you.
Thank you, Frank.
That psychiatrist and co-founder of the Asheville Jung Center, Steve Buser. The center is going to present a live webinar this Saturday on the psychology of fairy tales. You can find out more about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. And Brent Wolf is WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.